Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Anthony Anderson, Philip Beverly, Salim Uwakil, and Doug O'Brien. Our program tonight coming to my home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. Well, a little bit later on in the broadcast this evening, we will be talking about the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. But again, the news of the world dominates our discussion in the first hour of this evening, and that is the growing situation in Syria, a very serious situation in Syria. Late this afternoon, the United Nations announced that Syria had agreed to let inspectors in to the area where alleged chemical weapon attacks took place last week. I say alleged because we've seen the pictures. It's now being investigated, and now the UN is going to be allowed to go in there, but it may be a little bit too late. White House officials this afternoon issued some statements, and I'm going to read some of them to you. Quote, "We have seen the reports that after 5 days of refusing to allow the UN investigative team immediate and unimpeded access to the site of a reported August 21st chemical weapons attack, the regime may allow access tomorrow. If the Syrian government had nothing to hide and wanted to prove to the world that it had not used chemical weapons in this incident, it would have ceased its attacks on the area and granted immediate access to the United Nations 5 days ago. At this juncture, the belated decision by the regime to grant access to the UN team is too late to be credible, including because the evidence available has been significantly corrupted as a result of the regime's persistent shelling and other intentional actions over the last 5 days. As you also know, the United States is on heavy military alert. We're planning some sort of military response. Salim Muakil, we've heard that we've been to this movie before. We've seen incidents where the United States was about to act militarily, and then the grieving country involved says, "Well, no, we're going to let the inspectors in." Do you think it is too little, too late to stop some sort of a military action against the Syrian regime?
No, I think that we should never, I think we should be very wary about any kind of military action against the Syrian regime. It would have too many repercussions. And if we do anything, it should be on the basis of very deliberate consideration of the evidence available. And as of yet, and one thing I'm a little surprised at, it seems like it's overwhelming evidence that the Assad regime has used these chemical weapons, but many of the monitoring agencies are reluctant to blame them outright. So there must be some suspicion that it could be some other reason for
Anthony
this.
Anderson is one of our Republicans this evening. Anthony, you're a former U.S. Marine. We should mention that that Salim served in the U.S. Air Force.
Yes,
so we've got some military expertise here. But as a Republican, what is your reaction? And is military action now inevitable, given the sort of the line in the sand that the president
has drawn? I don't know if military action is inevitable, but I do know this, given the fact that, you know, in the past, in regards to that area, that region, if you look at in the past, Iraq, they were given like 17 or 18 different UN resolutions. Saddam Hussein never came straight, even after years and years of, you know, going after this guy. Mm-hmm. So for the Assad regime to come back just a week after and say, okay, we're going to let the UN inspectors come in and take a look at everything, I mean, that's a pretty safe. I'm okay with that timeline. 1 week is okay with me, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay. Philip Beverly, your reaction to what you've heard thus far?
I guess I'd be concerned about the degradation of the available evidence. If we believe that the injuries that were reported through the pictures were caused by a chemical attack, but we still need to take the biological samples to prove that. And I don't know that we'll get that. because depending on the kind of chemical, its breakdown over time and the destruction of where it was launched. And I don't believe that the inspector issue is going to prevent anything. I think we're going to do something militarily.
Doug O'Brien, another one of our Republicans, your reaction to the timing on this and whether or not, as Anthony suggested, maybe another 5 days is maybe prudent to wait.
Well, I think one of the problems is what is on the other side of the ultimatum? What is the or else? Because I think if our objective here is to try to end, do what we can to end the killing, the wholesale killing, we've got to have a pretty clear definition of what it is that we are willing and not willing to do. Because I think, as we know, in that part of the world, a measured or reluctant military response can leave the country in greater chaos and perpetuate the killing that's going on there already.
Do you agree with that, Salim?
I do. I think because what's at stake in Syria is something extremely dangerous, I think. Is that the serious sectarian, low-intensity civil war in Islam. And this is kind of a flashpoint for that. So I think we need to do everything we can to mediate that in a serious and sober way. That means getting the Russians involved. That means getting Iran involved before we take any kind of precipitous military action.
Would everyone agree that, again, if the UN inspectors are going to go in there in 5 days, that it would be absolutely foolish for the Assad regime to do anything egregious in the next 5 days?
You could say it was foolish for them to do this.
Right. The use of chemical weapons was, when the president said that's the line in the sand, you crossed
that. That was a year ago. He said that a year ago.
And now seems to be clear evidence of that. I think we're obligated now to act militarily.
Still,
and unfortunately, this is one of those, you break it, you bought it. So as soon as we push the button on cruise missiles or stealth bombers or whatever platforms we're going to use, we're committed to the after the military action.
But before that obligation of military action, I think that there has to be 100% proof that it was the Syrian government who actually authorized the use of chemical weapons. I do not want this country to go down that road again where we have a general such as Colin Powell making these assertions about Iraq. We devote all these resources to a region, come to find out there's nothing there.
The White House did say, because when you look at it from the Syrian perspective, the Assad regime is blaming the rebels.
Absolutely.
Rebels are blaming. So, again, there's a civil war, so
Absolutely.
You don't expect them to agree on anything.
Absolutely.
But in this particular case, the White House has specifically singled out the Assad regime, the government. They did not talk about the rebels.
Mm-hmm.
Do you put credibility in that?
Well, I just don't know, Bruce, because I just find it hard to believe. It's sort of hard for me to sit here and try to protect the Assad regime when you know what they've done in the past. But the fact of the matter is this. Will it make sense for them to do such a thing when they know that the United Nations is on its way in there?
Exactly.
I also, when we come back,
it doesn't make any sense.
I want to, because we're talking about the hard evidence and waiting for the investigation to take place. When we come back, I want to get everyone's reaction around the table and those listening from coast to coast and border to border. What about the pictures that many of us have already seen before? The photographic evidence that's there. How do you react to that? 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont from Chicago. From Youngstown State to Old Dominion, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, coast to coast and border to border. 1-800-723-8289. We'll go to calls in a moment. But again, we're talking about whether or not there's hard evidence as to whether or not chemical weapons were used in Syria against the Syrian people. What do you make, Anthony? We'll start with you. What do you make of the photographs? I mean, the films that have been on worldwide television. I mean, don't they tell a story? I mean, it doesn't say who did it, but there appears to be no doubt that there was.
Those photos are horrific in nature. I mean, it goes without saying. Whatever animal unleashed this type of thing on an innocent civilian population, there can be nothing said insofar as, you know, what can be done to, you know, get this situation under control. Hopefully we'll get to the bottom of this and find out exactly who released these chemical weapons on this population.
I want to get everybody's reaction to just the photographs. Philip Beverly.
The photographs, photographic evidence, horrific, absolutely. And I guess my greatest fear is that the on-the-ground evidence will be inconclusive. And so they'll be left with, but the photos that really pull at the heartstrings without the other substantial evidence of who actually pulled the trigger.
Doug O'Brien.
I would agree that you know, we're also talking about a part of the world where absolute fact, where black and white distinctions are often very hard to come by. And to rely on photographic evidence that can be emotional to make policy decisions, I'm confident that the administration and that the Defense Department is going to be taking a much harder look at getting biological evidence that they can use to base their decision on.
Salim, when you were in the survey, you were in the intelligence mm-hmm. section. Mm-hmm. So again, you know that intelligence can be closely watched. You also know that intelligence or propaganda can be easily manipulated. So we see these horrendous pictures. The world rises up because it follows sort of the MO of the Assad regime. But it would not be the first time in history that rebels would create a situation to divert attention towards their enemy.
Absolutely.
And so that the world overreacts against their enemy.
Especially,
we're not saying that happened here, but...
Well, it is a great possibility. I mean, because as Anthony pointed out, the Assad regime really has no they would really have no reason to endanger their battlefield gains that they've made primarily because of Hezbollah's assistance, and they would really endanger their own progress by unleashing these kinds of fearsome and really unnecessary weapons. But the rebels have everything to gain by revealing those kinds of weapons, because they would get assistance from other...
And they're not without their sophistication, both
not at
in
all.
Terms of their technology and their
Absolutely.
Supply lines.
And they just recently captured a cache of weapons in their possession, some of which indicated it may have been some chemical weapons. So it's still a very fuzzy process, and if the UN inspectors are come in, that may help clarify.
The president said a year ago, August 20th of last year, that's when he said, when he talked about the line, the red line, it was passed, when he said that it was not going to be acceptable if there was chemical weapons that was used in Syria. It's now a year later. There now appears to be some evidence, certainly the photographic evidence, is that they were used. The White House is referring to the regime. They're talking about the regime. They're not talking about the rebels. What can you tell us about the rebels? For those who have not been following this, Philip Beverly, who are these rebels? And can they be good guys? Are there good guys and bad guys? We know that Assad is a bad guy. Are we dealing with two bad guys here?
Yes, they're both.
Before you say that, I want to say one thing about Assad. You know, like him or not, Assad was there, and he did protect the 10% minority Coptic Christians. Now, those people are right now being persecuted. You have nuns being strung through the street by Muslim fundamentalists, and Assad, prior to this date, was never – he never went after those guys the way these Muslim fundamentalists
exactly
are going
right.
after these people right
non-sectarian.
Now. So this is violence. Mm-hmm. Don't make no mistake about it that this is a Muslim-on-Muslim violence, but in the end – the one Muslim that we probably can deal with, which is Assad, which we don't want to deal with, he was there to protect the minority and the Coptic Christians
there you go.
in that area of the world.
You've got, I think, several groups, and I don't know that any of them could be considered good in that way. They're all going to be self-interested. They all sort of – the groups run the spectrum sort of ideologically along the continuum of Islam, some – much more fundamentalist. You've got foreign fighters there from all over the Islamic world. There's not this monolithic rebel force that you're going to be able to deal with.
And I do believe that Egypt has the largest Muslim population in the world.
Arab population.
Yeah. Arab population.
Indonesia
Arab.
Has a large
Indonesia.
But interestingly, as you started out by saying we've seen this play before, what we saw in Iran in the 70s, we saw it in recent years in in Libya, in Egypt, is that we see a rebellion that has at the tip of the spear, if you will, intellectuals, a small middle class, a well-educated group of people pushing for more openness and freedom in a very tightly controlled dictatorial government. However, that is such a small number of people in Middle Eastern countries that very quickly those revolutions are subsumed by the more numerous, oftentimes fundamentalist movements that really drown out that more Western, more secular. Right,
yeah.
Which you saw in Egypt, you saw in Tahrir Square, you saw
more numerous and more ideologically coherent.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the major issues here is that they have that kind of coherence that can attract like these foreign fighters and whatnot.
Right.
It
mm-hmm.
brings
yep.
them in because they.
And I understand this is a civil war, but I don't want anybody to lose fact of the matter that even during this country's own civil war, we lost over 700,000 Americans. Not to diminish the lives of those who have been life lost at this point in right. Syria, but you know, lives will be lost in a civil war.
This is on the front burner of world attention right now because of the use of chemical weapons. Why is the use of chemical weapons on his own people, allegedly? Why is that worse than slaughtering people and shooting them down in the streets because they're protesting in Cairo? Philip Beverly.
Wow, I don't know that it is worse. I think it...
But we've been watching that for three or four weeks now.
Yeah, I think the thing with chemical weapons, if dealing with them, they can have longer lasting impacts because they're not going to kill everybody, but they can injure and then impact with the injury. Those are horrific injuries. I mean,
the environment, and food and the ability. I mean, that's one of the other humanitarian tragic stories
almost,
that is in the story
today.
Is that
death.
Families don't even know if the food or the water they drink or the food they use is good enough. I mean, that was one of the stories today. So I mean, it's a horrendous humanitarian issue. Mm-hmm. I want to go back to something to your experience. Again, you're a former U.S. Marine, and you served in Desert Storm. And you were there in the days when you had to get suited up because you feared that Saddam Hussein was going to use chemical weapons against you. Tell us about that story and the preparation for
it. Absolutely, Bruce. I can remember it was like yesterday almost.
Never forget.
Right. Back in August 2nd when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, 1981. Actually, my mother had passed just the month prior to that date. And he had invaded Kuwait on the 2nd of August. Our unit got the orders to leave. From that day, we went to 29 Palms, California. By August 12th, we were already in Saudi Arabia. This country had already committed its resources to Saudi Arabia and helping the country of Kuwait. Now, during that time period, once we had Operation, there's a Desert Storm and then there's a Desert Shield. I was involved in both. I was in that country for about a year or so, well, almost a year or so. But during the time that the
Saudi
war
Arabia?
Actually took place, Saudi Arabia, yes, absolutely. Because I was a Marine, mm-hmm. What we had to do were, I was a part of Task Force Ripper. And our mission at that time was to take over the airport, the Kuwaiti airport. You had the army, they flanked from the left. You had the Arab forces coming from the sea, and then you had the Marines pulling up through the middle, and our objective was to take the airport. Now, in that time period, during this fight, we had Dawn on mop gear, and that's the term that's used in the military to make sure if there was a chemical attack or some sort of weapons attack that we would be protected. And at the same time, you had to take these drugs that were given to you at the time because you didn't know whether or not there were actually chemical weapons being used. Now, mind you, at this time, when we were fighting the Arab forces, at least Saddam Hussein at this point, the Iraqi army, I was with the 1st Combat Engineer Battalion, 1st Marine Division, Fleet Marine Force Pacific, and our objective was to, you know, blow up minefields for the rest of the forces that were entering the country. So, you know,
wow.
When you were blowing up minefields, all these that booby traps and everything, so we didn't know whether or not they were actually
setting
using chemical weapons, so we had to actually, you know, don gear on. Mm. And so,
also, I just want to interrupt that. We should put this in context. part of the buildup, part of the creation of Saddam Hussein as a boogeyman was not just that he moved into Kuwait, but there was the threat that he was going to blow up the oil fields. That was number one. And also, there was the threat that he was going to use chemical weapons on any soldiers. So,
which he did against his own population.
That's right. The same MO we're dealing with now.
Absolutely.
But the United States, as their military action, so that was what they believed. So they made sure that every soldier that was going through there had gone through, and it was 115, 20
degrees? It had to
degrees.
Be at least in Saudi Arabia. I mean, when I got off the plane that day, and I was like 19 or 20 at the time, and it was like I got off the plane. I was like, wow, this is hotter than I can ever thought it was in Chicago. Are you serious? The water, unbelievable. The water is just unbelievable.
Dry heat.
I was like, this
okay,
is unbelievable. Right. But I was 19. I was Marine Corps.
Right. We got to pause. 1-800-723-8020. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about the United States policy in Syria and whether or not you believe military action now against the Assad regime is a wise decision for the United States. 1-800-723-8029. From coast to coast and border to border every Sunday night, I'm Bruce Dumont in Chicago. From Poughkeepsie, New York to Paducah, Kentucky, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, coast to coast and border to border. Nice to have you with us tonight. Let us introduce our guests, or let them introduce themselves. First of all, let's start with Salim Muakil. Salim, a little bit about your background.
I'm Salim Muakil. I'm from the East Coast, New York, New Jersey area. Went to Rutgers University, journalism, Air Force. I spent some time in security service in the Air Force. I got out, joined the Black Panther Party. Became very active in the Panther Party, became disenchanted, joined the Nation of Islam for a while, and came to Chicago as an editor for Muhammad Speaks. I was invited here by the leader of the Nation of Islam, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He gave me a phone call. So I've been in Chicago ever since. I've left the Nation of Islam and do journalism primarily.
One thing I want to ask you, and I don't think I've ever asked you this question. Because of your involvement with Air Force and in security for the Air Force, did that raise suspicions by your friends in the new Black Panther Party?
The original, right. No, because I didn't even know really how deeply the security service was involved with the NSA. I received a top secret clearance. They went to my home in New York and New Jersey and checked out my friends and whatnot and did a pretty good job probing me. So that never really played a big part because when I left the Air Force, I left in a huff, so to speak. I had gotten shot in Georgia, in Warner Robins, Georgia, and I spent my time in the hospital. And, in fact, that's when I became ideologically a Black Panther member at that time. And primarily in anger at getting shot by this guy in Georgia, and I left the Air Force.
Was it racial?
It was racial. Yes, okay. It was. But it was I instigated it.
Okay.
And got shot and had to I spent most of my time in the last part of 1968 recovering from my gunshot. I had to stay in the Air Force 7 months past my regular discharge date in order to be, in good shape, in order to leave. And as soon as I left the Air Force, I joined the Black Panther Party.
All right. Anthony Anderson, can you top that story?
He's been around a long time. He definitely has some experiences. I'm Anthony Anderson, chairman of Republican Precinct Project. It's an organization dedicated to refilling every precinct in the state of Illinois with Republicans. I'm also a state employee with the Department of Juvenile Justice. I've been there for about 20 years or so. I'm also a Marine Corps, combat action veteran.
And for those listening to the broadcast on radio, you are an African-American Republican.
Absolutely, African-American Republican.
Philip Beverly, you are an African-American Democrat.
I'm an African-American Democrat, big D. I'm an associate professor of political science at Chicago State University. I've been doing that for 22 years now. A student of the process, run political campaigns sort of locally, and try and get folks involved, civic engagement.
Doug O'Brien.
Thanks, Bruce. I'm Doug O'Brien. I'm the principal with Prairie State Strategies. It's a public affairs consulting firm here in Chicago, primarily working in healthcare and energy sectors. Spent time on Capitol Hill and with the federal government, in addition to working with state government here in Illinois, and I'm a veteran of, I don't even know how many campaigns, political campaigns.
Joining us now is Youngstown, Ohio's favorite Ray, listening to us on WKBN. Go ahead, Ray. You're on the air. Thanks for being patient.
Yeah, good evening, gentlemen. And it sounds like you have a very good panel there.
Good evening.
I'm calling. I got 3 points that I think I'd like to make. And one of them is about Martin Luther King. I believe even people in Martin Luther King's own camp didn't believe that he could succeed with a nonviolent revolution, but he proved them wrong, and he did succeed. And I was only about 12 years old when they killed President Kennedy, and I believe that that changed this country. At that time, I'm not positive we'd have been in Vietnam if President Kennedy hadn't been assassinated. But we used chemical weapons in Vietnam, in napalm, in Agent Orange, which is dioxin, which is in their animals, it's in that sea, it's in the sand. I think it'll be there forever from now on. Now, I'm very uneducated about what's going on in the Middle East, but just the panel there is. And I believe in Saudi Arabia, they can take care of their own oil fields. They don't need our help. And I got the belief that people wanted us to go into Vietnam to try to swing that Cold War, and
let's bring it to where we are right now. What do you think the United States should be doing in Syria to stop at least the photographic evidence that chemical weapons were used against the people?
Well, I'm very uneducated about that part of the country, and your guests are probably way more educated than I am, and that is my question, is more of a conscientious type of question that maybe a person like Martin Luther King or President Kennedy or even Bobby Kennedy would have looked at differently than maybe some of our leaders now.
Well, as our program, thank you very much for your call. As our program unfolds this evening, we are going to be talking about the civil rights movement, specifically the anniversary of the famous, I Have a Dream speech. And we will slide into that in just a few months if we button up our discussion about Syria. And that we should also mention that Syria has warned the United States against any military action over the suspected poison gas attack in their civil war. And this is a direct quote. U.S. military intervention will create a very serious fallout and a ball of fire that will inflame the Middle East. Iran also has weighed in. They said that there will, if there's any intervention by Washington, there will be severe consequences. America knows the limitation of the red line of the Syrian front, and any crossing of Syria's red line will have severe consequences for the White House. That was a senior official in Syria. And also we should mention that the Soviet Union, the Russia, which has they have a seat on the Security Council for those that want the UN involved, and it will be UN inspectors that we're going to be going in there very shortly to look at the evidence here. They certainly send a signal that they will use their veto, and they basically said, let's give the Syrians a little more time. And how does this, with all the things that are going on in U.S.-Russian relations now, Philip, where does this fit into everything else that's going on over there?
I think this makes the situation between our two countries much tenser. The Russians have just refused to give an inch on any of this. And I think the president, in the last major step that he take, canceling a meeting with Putin, was saying, okay, enough. Enough of supporting a regime that is willing to do what that regime is doing. I think they're trying to work this thing out politically, and I don't think that there's a political solution here.
Is there anybody at the table who believes that if the rest of the world decides to do nothing, and again, at this particular moment, we are reaching out to the British, we're reaching out to the French, we're reaching out to Turkey, We're dealing in a, we don't want to do this unilaterally. Does anybody think that maybe we should do it unilaterally if
no.
we can't get everybody? Is everybody?
Absolutely not.
No.
There shouldn't be any strategic hits on this country. I mean, if you look at what's going on, especially when you were talking about Russia, that Russians had their own problems with the Chechens, mm-hmm. Muslim separatists out in Chechnya. And so they don't want to see this threat of Muslim, this fanaticism spread from their borders to the Egyptian border, to the Syria border, and to all these different areas within that Muslim world, because it can only get bad for them in their own part.
Doug, what about, is there any part of you that says we should act unilaterally if that's all we can do?
Well, I think we saw that in the case of Iraq, we had to bring to bear virtually all the force that the United States can muster. And clearly, we subjugated a relatively powerful military very quickly. That wasn't the problem. The problem came after. And if the U.S. wants to impose its will anywhere in the Middle East, not only can we not do it tentatively militarily, we have to make an overwhelming commitment militarily, but then we have to have, as people said, the exit strategy or the ongoing strategy.
Look at what happened when the United States had threatened to pull back $1.5 billion. Immediately, what happened? The Saudis said they would give mm-hmm. them $15 billion.
Right.
So it's obvious that we're starting to lose influence and power in that region of the world that happens to threaten a lot of our sovereignty. And so
our credibility in the region for a lot of different reasons has waned tremendously. And I think a lot of it has to do with coming to the realization that we are, even though we're the strongest country in the world, we're very limited in that part of the world in what that physical might can effectuate. We've seen that in Afghanistan. We've seen it in Iraq. And we've seen it historically.
Do we have, and again, you mentioned, I think, in response to the first question this evening, you talk about how are the Iranians, how are other countries in the region, how are they reacting to we drew the line in the sand a year ago, we've been pussyfooting around with it now, it appears like we're talking tough, we're getting ready with the cruise missiles, at least those that were on the Sunday shows today suggesting that, you know, we're going to be somewhat reserved. We don't want any U.S. plane shot down, so we're not going to go into Syrian airspace. But we can probably wage this from 30,000 feet, which Democrats like to wage war at 30,000 feet more than Republicans. Do you agree with that, Philip? It's easier to wage war at 30,000 feet?
I think this president will do militarily what the generals say to do. I don't think that he's going to – I see much more a Libya strategy here than an Iraq strategy.
A more tempered response, maybe?
I think it'll be a very precise response, yeah.
Let's find out when we come back. I want to find out how does the rest of the region, and specifically, how does Iran react to the way we're acting right now to this situation? What lessons are they learning about Barack Obama? Back shortly. From Boston, Massachusetts to Houston, Texas, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Let's head to Texas now. Austin is the place. KLBJ is the station, and Bill is the caller. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, before the Iraq war, Obama said that it was the wrong war because Saddam's use of chemical weapons was not a cause for war. So why is Assad's use of chemical weapons not a cause for war? And everybody seems to think that it is. I thought that it was necessary to take Saddam out after 9/11, but Obama said that was the wrong war because use of chemical weapons is apparently not a problem, and now it is. I'm just sort of curious.
Bill, I don't remember candidate Obama or Senator Obama specifically talking about chemical weapons. I mean,
he said Iraq was the wrong war.
No, he definitely said that, but he didn't. I don't think he said that. I don't think it had anything to do with chemical weapons. He opposed that war, and he said the right war was Afghanistan.
Somebody that uses chemical weapons on civilians because Saddam, we had proof that he did it. We have no proof that Assad did it.
We gave him the weapons. Yeah. We provided those weapons to him.
The French and the Germans.
Bill, let me ask you the question that I asked of the panel in the last segment. In your view, why is the use of chemical weapons against people any worse than shooting citizens down in the street What's the difference?
Everybody agrees it is. You know, I agree it is too. I say nuke Assad back into the Stone Age, but candidate Obama says no. As long as he quits using them when we ask him to, it's okay.
What impact? Thanks very much for your call. Doug, I want to get your reaction. We've not talked about Israel yet. What is Israel thinking about right now?
And I think that's one of the answers to your question about conventional versus chemical weapons, because obviously conventional weapons are used in a much more limited area. And even if you're using artillery, it's still a point-to-point weapon, whereas a chemical weapon has the ability to spread. You know, the idea here in a civil war or a revolution, people take to the streets and decide to take up arms against their government. It's warfare. Whereas chemical weapons can just be used to kill every living creature in a town, or, and in this case, something that we have to be very concerned about, they can be used to attack Israel, which I think is the kind of illogical, capricious, and desperate move that somebody like Bashar Assad could certainly potentially make.
And I would imagine the Russians would prevent that, because they know that the Israelis have no hesitation in acting unilaterally to protect their interests. And they know if anything comes from Syria, the Israeli Defense Force will respond with a quickness.
Again, I think somebody like Assad, somebody like Assad backed into a corner. I don't see why people are demonizing Assad.
As Anthony pointed out, he's been a rather responsible tyrant as far as tyrants go. And Bruce asked about Iran and Iraq and how they feel about this activity. I think one of the things we misperceive is that Iran is looking at this as a sectarian issue. Iran is a Shia nation. Syria is essentially a Shia nation. Their allies, the Alawites, who Assad is affiliated with, is kind of a Shia offshoot. And Iraq is basically a Shia nation right now. So they're looking at this in a sectarian way, in a way that is not quite on the radar of the United States. And we are misperceiving, I think, a lot of their motives.
When a Syrian information officer uses words like very serious fallout and a ball of fire that will inflame the Middle East, is that just good propaganda?
Part of it's a gift for rhetoric. I think we're pretty used to
it.
There's wiping things off the map. Yeah, balls of fire. You know.
By the way, we talked about who was responsible for, but the one thing there appears to be, not only is there the photographic evidence, but a group called Doctors Without Borders, which is a nonpartisan group. They have reported to the Global Humanitarian Group that they received roughly 3,600 patients showing neurotoxic symptoms in less than 3 hours last Wednesday, 355 of whom reportedly died. Although the group can neither scientifically confirm the cause of these symptoms nor establish who is responsible for the attack, which we know, they strongly indicate mass exposure to a neurotoxic...
But let's not forget, Bruce, for a few months ago, there were some accusations that chemical weapons may have been used also. It's not until we saw pictures of it, actually, that there's this outrage against this regime.
And so, again, for those people that just tuned in, the United Nations announced that, our Syrian government announced that they're going to let the UN inspectors in the next few days. Does anyone at this table think that's going to resolve? And so next Sunday night, if we all got together, the picture would be real clear, or will the picture still be murky?
The picture will be much fuzzier, I think, by next week, because they'll have some evidence, but the evidence of who will still be inconclusive. And so the United States is left with, now what do we do in response to this?
Especially with Russia and China indicating that they're certainly not going to accept any sort of UN intervention.
Doesn't this once again demonstrate the absolute uselessness of the United Nations? Anthony.
Absolutely. It's almost like we can't get anything right when it comes to the United Nations. There has to be a clear-cut case of, you know, who done it, when they did it, and how they did it.
Salim, what about it?
Well, I'm saying Doctors Without Borders, the fact that they didn't come out more explicitly and condemn the Assad regime makes me question just how conclusive this evidence is.
Okay. UN.
I would
10
wonder,
seconds on the UN.
I would wonder if the Doctors Without Borders pretty much don't want to jeopardize their position there.
Okay. We are out of time for this discussion, this broadcast. If you're listening to this program on radio, we're going to be here for another full hour. And in the next hour, we're going to be talking about the Civil Rights Movement 50 years after Dr. King's speech and the March on Washington. If you're watching this show on television, we'll see you next week. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Anthony Anderson, Philip Beverly, Salim Uwakil, and Doug O'Brien. Our program tonight coming to you from the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. Well, for the next hour, we're going to be looking back. We're going to be looking back 50 years to the historic March on Washington and the I Have a Dream speech, which really was one of the great, if not the greatest, speech of the 20th century, because it changed America in a significant way. And in the next hour, we're going to be talking about how it changed America and whether or not Dr. King's dream is alive and well. And we begin by asking Salim Uwakil. You were 16 years old. You were actually at the march. Mm-hmm. If Dr. King were alive today, would he be satisfied with the advancement that's been made by African Americans in this country?
I think he would be ambivalent. He would be satisfied with some things. For example, an African American president that was inconceivable to many at that time. But I think he would also be a bit disappointed with the way things have happened in terms of the poverty rates in the African American community, the disparities between the rich and the poor, the increasing warlike nature of this country and whatnot. So I think there are, you know, he would be a bit ambivalent.
Anthony Anderson, one of our Republicans tonight. Anthony?
I want to echo some of that sentiment that you were just sharing. One of the things that March was all about, the March on Washington, was about jobs and freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. King's vision of freedom, I think, was for the most part realized because we were able to freely associate with one another and assimilate with the American culture. But in terms of jobs, like you were just saying earlier, we're still having a huge problem, especially within the black community, in terms of jobs and education and poverty. If you look at some of the statistics, even right here in Chicago, on the north side of Chicago, there's an unemployment rate of about 5%. You go into some parts of the south side or some parts of the west side, it's up to 40%. And some of the, and these are young black males that are uneducated and don't have any jobs. And so, again, there are some things that we can do, need to do better, especially when there's a black president in charge.
Philip Beverly, I want to ask you a little bit different question. If you were to look back on that speech, were there some things in that speech that Dr. King avoided putting in that speech because he wanted to focus his attention on what government could do to change the economic landscape, and maybe he did not talk a lot about cultural issues, and aren't those some of the issues that we are still dealing with today that are not much better, if in some cases maybe worse than 50 years ago?
Absolutely. We haven't had the national dialogue, the national conversation about sort of post-slavery and what that has meant in the psyche of the entire country. Because everyone, I believe, in every American has been wounded by it. even if they don't know it. I don't think he talked about sort of the responsibility in the black community to do what's necessary to take advantage of the things that are made available as a result of the movement, the civil rights movement. I was heartbroken at the Trayvon Martin decision, for example, and yet I was equally sort of saddened by the lack of outrage of a 4-year-old girl being killed in this city at the same time. And where was the same outrage to say that's not acceptable in this community? And I think that was one of those things that's avoided, that says, oh no, we're not going to place any responsibility on you. And it needs to be put there.
Doug O'Brien is another one of our Republicans. Doug, as you look at all of the coverage of 50 years, and you look at the speech, we know it's one of the great speeches of all time, mm-hmm. as I said. Are too many political leaders of all stripes and all colors, are too many of them focused on looking at it in a historical standpoint, and they're acknowledging that it was a great speech, but how many of them are comfortable in saying that things are significantly better for African Americans and those at the lower rung of the economic ladder?
I think it's hard to make definitive statements because it's clear that there's a mixed report card, and there's still a great deal of progress we need to make. And I think that there are a couple of things. You know, Philip made a very good point. I think Dr. King would be sorely disappointed at some of the lack of accountability within the African American community. And I think that certainly the gang violence, the violence that we see in the African American community would outrage Dr. King. But also I think that we still are at a point where the crux of that speech was about a time when people were not judged by the color of their skin but by the content of their character. And the only thing we as a society and as a country have been able to come up with as a recipe to get to a post-racial society continues to be identifying people by the color of their skin rather than the content of their character.
But you also judge people and the content of their heart. You also judge people by the jobs they have, by the way they present themselves, in other ways. And some of these ways get back to cultural ways, and they get back to some of the significant cultural things that were first addressed by Daniel Patrick Moynihan in his controversial report of 1965, in which he talked about the differences between being black and being white in America. And I'm wondering, as we look at where black leadership took the challenge of Dr. King's speech, would it be safe to assume, and again, I want to be educated on this, would it be safe to be assume that Minister Louis Farrakhan talked more about issues of cultural, behavioral change, discipline, much more so than Dr. King ever did?
Yeah, in fact, that was the major distinction in during this particular period. Malcolm X was a critic of the march precisely for that reason, because the way the Nation of Islam construed it is that it forced a dependency. It reinforced this whole dependent attitude that African Americans have. And it should be avoided. So, and there's always been what we call two trains running in the African American movement tradition. One dealing with the structural barriers that the white America presents, and the other dealing with the cultural issues that black Americans have to deal with on their own.
Anthony, is there a way that, again, 50 years looking at, by the way, some of the statistics, by the way, in 1966, which was the earliest year in which comparative data was available, 42% of African Americans lived in poverty. In 2011, only 28% did. The income of the median black family, the one in the middle of the statistical middle, is 80% higher, adjusted for inflation, than a comparable family in 1963. And there are other things that we want to deal with, including I want to talk about incarceration rates, because certainly Dr. King would not be comfortable with the incarceration rate of the country, and certainly not amongst young black men. 1-800-723-8020. We've got callers on the line. We're looking at 50 years plus the March on Washington in 1963. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's head west to Sacramento, California, where Ron is listening to us on KTKZ. Go ahead. You're on the air.
All right. Yes. Good panel there. I just think that Martin Luther King, in some respects, would be a little nonplussed with the whole civil rights war. He was kind of colorblind, but it seems to be the whole movement has gotten kind of self-absorbed when you consider Oprah Winfrey and her $35,000 handbag thing, and hypocritical, and if not shameful, in that the serious lack of leadership for the onslaught of crime by younger blacks, the 88-year-old white guy that was murdered, the Australian kid, and many others, including in Houston. There's a trial now for Mona Nelson, a black woman that kidnapped a white kid, 12-year-old Foster. It should be on the news every day, but it's not. That Jonathan Foster took a blowtorch at 6,000 degrees.
All right, sir. What is your
I'd like to hear this addressed and get away from the self-absorbed, I me mind, how dark be my behind, sense of so-called phony civil rights. Let's get real. How about the white community, the European American community? Let's address the case in Houston. Every one of you, the Foster kid that was burned with a blowtorch.
All right, sir. All right, sir. I think, sir, you've made your point. I think you're a little off topic, if I might say. You've made your point. I think your point is a point that's probably agreed to by a lot of people that are listening to this broadcast this evening. What we're trying to discuss this evening is when we look back 50 years ago, and I would hope that there's no one, even those that may not have been, you know, huge fans of what Dr. King was trying to do 50 years ago. I don't think there's anyone that is going to doubt that he was a significant figure and that much has changed. Much has changed in a very positive way. But we look at issues that exist in the black family on the south and west sides of Chicago and in urban areas all around the United States. There's too much crime, period. Not just black-on-black crime. There's too much crime. There's too much poverty. There are too many homes without a father. There are too many homes with unwed mothers. I mean, this goes across the board. It is larger in the African-American community than in the white community, but there's problems of teen pregnancy and unwanted children in rural white America as well. You know, there may be a crack problem on the streets of urban America. There's meth problems in the rural areas and the poor white areas of America.
As a matter of fact, there's a heroin epidemic in the white community at this point.
Right. Yeah. So there are huge problems. But the one thing that again needs, I think, to be addressed, and that is if we were to come back here in 50 years from now, I'm talking about what are we doing in the next 50 years, it seems to me that the one common denominator that has not been addressed significantly, and that is improving the education system. The education system is broken in this country for many African Americans and for many lower income people.
Like the Reverend Jesse Jackson was saying, not this word, we can't have a first-rate justice system or a first-rate criminal justice system and a second-rate educational system. It won't work. And as long as that's in place like that, we're going to be in a situation for a long time coming.
And I don't know that the system is necessarily broken. I'm a both-and kind of guy. And so for me, coming from a family of educators, you can't send your six-year-old to first grade and they not know their full name and their address and their parents' name and their phone number. And no politician alive is ever going to say to parents, potential voters, you have some responsibility for the education of your child. Instead, as a society, we place it on education systems that now need to be everything. They need to have the social worker and the psychologist and the nutritionist and that system isn't designed to do that.
We talked about this a few weeks ago on this program, and I don't know whether you heard for that broadcast or not, but the point is, who is going to explain and to talk or to preach? And again, I said a few weeks ago, I think the American religious community could be doing a lot more to teaching some of these important cultural issues. But again, within those sectors, especially for young black men, they're not going to be listening to the preachers as much as they are, or their teachers. They're going to be listening to the rap stars and the cultural stuff. And I know you've got real strong feelings about this, Salim. But I mean, how much of the problem with black aspirations and black ability to get a job and keep a job and basically to sort of live in a society. Now, it's a white society, mm-hmm. but black people living in a white society that still control most of the money. That's mm-hmm. that's a reality of life.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the rap music and some of the stars and some of the people who use their podiums and their platforms don't do it with much respect for the betterment of the people who are their fans.
Well, you
Would
know,
you agree with that?
Yeah, to some extent, yes. I mean, music is always you know, risky and risque. I mean, that's what music does. It pushes boundaries. But you're talking about exhorting people, exhortation, trying to
lift them up,
trying to help folks act in a way that encourages success, to behave in ways that encourage success. Well, if that was all we needed, we would be some very successful people. I mean, they're more storefront churches in the black community than anywhere else, where people are exhorting all the time. It's not so much exhortations that do it; it's a change in structure. If you look at, for example, the Harlem Children's Zone in New York, Jeffrey Canada, who is using a very comprehensive method to improve the education of the children, to do parenting classes, prenatal nutritional classes, all of that in one attempt to do a holistic program. And that's what's necessary. We can't simply take out certain aspects of the socialization process, because black people have been socialized for subservience for generations, because that is our history in this country. And so you can't simply reverse that kind of socialization process and exhort people to act in a certain way. It takes a lot of work, a lot of comprehensive input and resource allocation.
But the popular culture glorifies
these are young irresponsible.
It glorifies them.
Young people need mentoring, and the fact of the matter is the gangs, for the most part, in these black communities have become the mentors for those individuals that have went away. And also the rap music, that's becoming mentoring for these young black folks. Mm-hmm. And so they're coming up with this mindset, this culture that they think is the way to get out of this environment that they're in, when it's not the case, and they're sadly mistaken.
I think it's actually much broader, because I think we talk about the 50 years since Dr. King's speech. I think hearts and minds in this country across the board have changed dramatically. Attitudes from my parents' generation, their parents' generation, to my generation, what I instill in my children. I think that's the great legacy that Dr. King has helped to bring about, is there really has been a change in hearts and minds, and there's been a change in institutions. We've invested more conscientiously as a country in education, but at the same time, there has been a concurrent dissolving of a lot of the cultural mores across the board, black, white, Hispanic, everywhere in this country. And I think that that's making it so much harder for the progress to take hold, because at the same time, we've had a cultural degradation.
Has the collective white leadership in America, be it at the political level, be it at the business level, be it at the academic level, have they bent over backwards? Have they done a better job of trying to lift up blacks to be successful? Have they done a better job than that?
Some
than
more
the
than
leadership
others.
In the black community?
No. Political leadership across the spectrum, and I think I'm more distasteful of the liberals and their sort of having to save people. You don't have to save anybody. You just have to sort of acknowledge what you do and your participation in the system. Educational leaders, not necessarily. It's still this emphasis on, oh, you want to go to college? Can you play basketball? Can you play football? We got a place for you if you can do that for us. But we're not going to invest in you to go there on a four-year scholarship to study chemistry. That's a problem for me. The business leaders, I don't get that they've done much. And quite frankly, why should they? Necessarily, well, you know, but, unless it helps their bottom line.
Every big company in this country and every institution of higher education has diversity programs, but in a sense they're teaching to the test, as we like to say in the educational system. They're checking boxes. Now, they're doing it, and it does provide a certain amount of opportunity and certain doors opening, but then we see the ramifications of it. We see in higher education, we see institutions checking boxes and then having students flunk out because they're ill-prepared. And it benefits no one. So at the same time that we're sort of dumbing down our whole culture in terms of not placing a premium on parents being married and trying to do things about unwed parents, and at the same time we're trying to institutionally change everything while...
What would you do to try to change that? And by the way, we should mention that the unwed, the situation of children born to unwed mothers, it's extremely, it's like 75% of the black community. It's not very impressive in the white community either.
No, but that's my point about the whole society, let's
make you the czar of American education or HEW the president. What would you do? What message or what messengers are needed to communicate to young people they should get married before they have children? And maybe you shouldn't have too many children if you can't afford to raise them and watch them and nurture them and love them.
Though those numbers are down, though, and I think part of that has been in the last few years the economy. Mm-hmm. And though I wasn't a fan of it at the time, the welfare reform from 96 I think has had a significant impact in providing a disincentive to that kind of behavior. And still, what are we going to do to improve the educational system and improve? Because here's, our young people are pretty smart. You can't tell them one thing and then say, oh, trust me on that, when they know that if they do A to get B, they're not going to get B.
When we come back, 1-800-723-8289. We have lots of callers. We'll talk about that. We'll also talk about incarceration in America. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Salim Muwakkil is here. He's a talk show host for WVON Radio, writes for In These Times, former member of the Black Panther Party. Also with us this evening is Anthony Anderson, former United States Marine. By the way, we should also mention that you were in the United States Air Force.
Air Force, yeah.
And also, Anthony, you were in the United States Marine Corps. You're now in the juvenile justice system in the state of Illinois as an administrator. And also, you're with a Republican precinct project, which is the idea to put a Republican precinct committeeman in every precinct in the state of Illinois. Philip Beverly also joins us. He is a professor of political science at Chicago State University. And Doug O'Brien joins us. He is a principal in Prairie State Strategies. And we've got callers on the line. Let's go to Michael in Elkhart, Indiana, listening to us on WMMC. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Bruce. Love your show.
Thank you.
Hey, I wonder to get a thought from your guest here. 36 straight months of job growth. The Dow is at an all-time record under President Obama. You know, stock market's booming. Economy's picking up a bit. 36 straight months of job growth. Dow is booming, like I said. 32 million Americans, unless the Republicans take the health care away, are going to be covered under the Affordable Care Act. And the comments I'm hearing, I live in Indiana, and I'm white, so I hear a lot of talk, you know, using derogatory terms, to the president, and his wife is uppity, and it's no longer the White House, it's the Black House. And 78%, Bruce, of all Americans that are on food stamps and welfare are Caucasian. Do you think that if Obama was, you know, white, with his roaring success, keeping us free from attack here in America and stock markets booming, 36 straight months of job growth, you know, the top 1% are really doing well. And by the way, the big five insurance companies, since the signing of the Affordable Care Act, their stocks are roaring. They're just soaring as, you know, they raise premiums and blame it on the black guy in the White House. But I'm hearing colored, I'm hearing Negro, I'm hearing uppity, I'm hearing Black House. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, Obama is the capitalist's best dream. Stock market, record high, you know, everything's just soaring.
Michael, I think your point, let me tackle it, and then I'll let the guest tackle it. There is a sector, there is a strain of the political, of people in the United States who are absolutely racist. There's no doubt about it. And until the sons and the grandsons of everyone who's alive today are dead and gone, another generation or two, maybe racism will move out even faster from our society. It's considerably better than it was 50 years ago. Eleanor Holmes said that, you know, 50 years ago it was, you know, you could be a racist. It's no longer respectable to be a racist. Now, you can say the things that you're talking about, and some of those people are racist, are certainly not educated. And I think that's it. They're not educated. They haven't had an experience in knowing black people or working with black people. But I think we have to put that in context with Barack Obama being elected president of the United States. He was elected because a large number of white people voted for him. They wanted to send a signal that their hearts were in the right place. They happened to believe that he was the best person to do that. I think, frankly, many of them voted for Barack Obama the first and the second time, believing that by being this aspirational leader, some of the cultural issues that really beset the African-American community and the crime and everything else that black Americans, not all black Americans, but black Americans living in certain segments and neighborhoods of this city and this country go through, that their life would be better. Because I think those people do want a better America. I think they want America to live up to all the words of all of our songs, to our national anthem, to our pledge, to everything else. I think they really believe that. And the number of white people who believe that way, as opposed to the number of people that speak in racially charged words and in inappropriate words, I think it's significantly larger. And I want to know whether anyone agrees or disagrees with what
I have to take slight issue with the implication that whites who voted for Barack Obama wanted to prove their hearts were in the right place. My heart's in the right place. I didn't vote for Barack Obama neither time. And I think it's a misperception. I know, Bruce, you didn't mean to imply that anybody who didn't vote for Barack Obama, who was white, did not have their heart in the right place. We in this country, and again, this is part of the legacy of Dr. King, and when I was talking about earlier about how we've made strides in the hearts and minds of Americans, we can have an African-American president and we can disagree with his policies without having it become racial. And I think, yes, Michael, who's very misinformed on a number of things, is right that there are racists in this country, and it's deplorable. But I think that is also exacerbated by those who take policy criticism of the president and try to turn that around and claim that it is racially motivated. That, to me, that is offensive, and it really is painful to me because I want our discourse to be healthier than that.
But on the other side of it, whenever issues of race come up, I'm always amazed that white commentators in the discourse always default to, oh no, it's not about race. How do you know that? And if it is distasteful to be racist, no one is going to ever cop to it and say, yeah, I disagree with them
because it's based on race. You have the perfect argument then, because you cannot disprove a negative. So anybody can fall back and say, well, your objection to the Affordable Care Act is racially motivated. No, it's based upon the fact that I know a lot about the healthcare system and I think it's going to be an absolute disaster.
And in that case, that's right. But when do you cop to, yeah, it is racially motivated? Are you going to tell me that the criticism that this president has gotten from your party has all been policy-based? That is so disingenuous. There are people who at a visceral level hate the man because he's black, and yet they can't say, yeah, I hate the guy because he's black, because that's unpalatable for us in this culture. Ironically, what he said, I trust people who use that language, who have those beliefs openly more than I trust people who won't say it to my face.
See, now this is a very, very dangerous place that you're going, because your implication is that anybody who has a policy difference with the president based upon policy, in your mind, can legitimately be accused of being a closet racist. And I cannot prove otherwise. You could say to me, Doug, I don't believe you. I think that you don't like him because he's a black man. And there's no way for me to prove otherwise.
No, well, Doug, I would like to say this.
You know, for those who subscribe to the Limbaugh cartel, they're going to think what they the way they think no matter what. Yeah. You know, and the fact of the matter is, had you had any other person in office, now here's a man in Obama that was a former state representative, a former United States senator. Now he's the president of the United States. He has a Harvard degree. He's an established man, him and his whole family. Now, according to the Republicans, this man can't do anything right. And so they're constantly throwing these accusations at this guy. It would be okay if they threw him a bone every once in a while. But every time he comes up with something, some policy, they're always harping on this man as if he can't do anything right. You name me one specific policy that they can agree on, and then I'll say, okay, maybe it's not racism. But every time he comes with a policy initiative, they're always saying it won't work in regards to what's going on.
I would say on some national security issues,
yeah.
on some of the extensions of Bush, war on terrorism,
Patriot Act,
NSA program. I mean, I think there's a long list of things that maybe Salim and some of his liberal friends would say, you know what, he's every bit as a he sometimes talks like Dick Cheney.
Absolutely.
Right?
Mm-hmm. In fact, I find myself in agreement with Rand Paul and those guys, the libertarians.
And they disagreed with Bush too.
They disagreed with Bush as well.
Let's go to Bryant listening to us in Redding, California, on KQMS. Go ahead, California.
Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hello.
Okay, two things. One, I think you may have mentioned it earlier, but remember, there have been blacks who have agreed with the issue that character is important. Bill Cosby, for one, several years ago mentioned it. And secondly, I think with the destruction of the family, especially with religious education within the blacks, has really decimated. I mean, what's the biggest thing against morality? It's always religious based. They want it kept private. They don't want to have anything to do with it in the public sector. And that alone is creating a lot of hardship, especially within the black community.
I think it's a mistake to say that only that very few black people are talking about character. That's the essential conversation in the black community is about character.
Absolutely.
And to say that I think this is a feeling that's at large that black people don't talk about these issues about unwed motherhood.
Mr. Farrakhan's been talking about it for 50 years.
Absolutely.
And so is Jesse Jackson to some extent.
Focusing on the black family.
Many of the pastors.
It's a consistent conversation, you know. But they're putting it in context. And in context, you know, there's a nuance that we add.
And the thing that's missing, when you still, 50 years later, have 40% of Americans surveyed in a recent survey, white Americans, do not know anybody other than whites. 40% of white America do not have friends that are non-white. Really? How does that happen, essentially? Because
how would blacks respond to the same question, whether they have white friends?
Probably the same numbers.
I asked a question on my Facebook page, that exact question, and very few black people have a lot of white friends.
So the problem is on both sides.
Everybody should get
to know each other a little bit better. Good idea. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's go to Dave listening to us in Naperville, Illinois on our flagship station, WLS Radio, the radio home of Dan Proft. Go ahead.
Yes, I listen to them and I listen to you almost every Sunday. Great show.
Terrific.
I have a lot of things I'd like to talk about just from what I heard on the time I've been waiting. First of all, I didn't vote for him. I despise him. It's not because of his race, but the one thing I think he handled better than President Bush and better than any of the other people involved is the way he took out Osama bin Laden is the way we should have took him out in the first place. So that is one thing I will say I am in strong agreement with. As far as what I heard otherwise, there's a lot of things. This guy who said there's a lot of jobs, well, most of the jobs are part-time. I'm not going to go any further than that. This business with the school system, the problem is we pass people who are not able to meet standards. We just push them along. They get into the real world, and it's unfortunate, but they're faced with reality at that time. As far as the social system, it creates kind of a dependency that it's very difficult to get out of. And in my opinion, if you wanted to take maybe a little stretch, it's kind of modern-day slavery. So the people who are the big politicians could control the votes, because without their money, they are not going to get. As far as children and this business, how to remedy families, there's one child benefit only. If you have a second child, there should be pressure on the mom to find out who the daddies are and get some help from them involved with this. Once you have a third child, you get cut off, or you're counseled, and maybe you're not a fit parent, and you don't need three kids if you can't afford them and take care of them.
Dave, thanks for your call. Thank you for your call. I want to ask a question. Within the African-American communities, is there much talk about the stigma of fatherless families? Do people talk about that when – what are they – Do those issues come up, Anthony?
Yeah, those issues come up on a consistent basis. I mean, there's no one woman out there that wants to have kids, especially without being wed or in a relationship where there's no security blanket, no safety, no social net. So, yeah, it comes up on a consistent basis, I believe.
You agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it does. But, you know, I think William Julius Wilson made the point that there are certain social situations, certain criteria that produce marriageable males, and those criteria are not available in most black communities. Primarily, no self-sustaining livable wage jobs that are available for a lot of young people. The community is not disciplined for work like it used to be. People don't go to bed early and get up the young children don't see that kind of social discipline in their neighborhoods.
Is there a stigma for going to prison, or because there's been such an increase in the prison population, all prison population, and certainly the African-American community? What is the stigma about going to prison in the black community?
Is
it a big deal?
I don't know that there is a stigma as much as there's just resignation that it's going to happen to a certain percentage of our young men. We've got guys who are involved in the pharmaceutical industry that's the employment that they have. And what comes with that is the concomitant risk of incarceration.
Pharmaceutical.
You're not talking about Abbott.
Not at Merck.
No. The underground economy is the only thriving commercial activity.
That's an interesting way of putting it, the pharmaceutical.
And, mm-hmm. and so there, I think there's this resignation that we'll take the risk and we know that they'll go to prison.
And I think that's
– Go back to that point. I don't think – There used to be a time when, you know, people were having kids, you know, by the boatload and going down to the AFDC office and, you know, going to apply for benefits. But nowadays, it's not the case so much. Black folks aren't having kids like that anymore and going down to the public aid office and getting help. That's not the way it works anymore.
One last just quick on this particular subject. Recently, the Attorney General announced some changes, significant changes at the federal level in mandatory minimums. Is that going to have an immediate effect, do you think, on the black community? Because one of the concerns I have is that, you know, the recidivist rate at the federal level is high, not as high as it is in state courts, or state prisons. But are there enough jobs if black men and white men are being released from prison because of this new executive order by the Attorney General. Are there enough jobs out there for them to have?
And the answer
no.
Or,
no.
No. Bruce, there was a study out there that out of the 31 major cities in this country, the unemployment rate in the black community was at 40%. Now, you take those same 31 cities and you break it down to six cities, the unemployment rate is at 50% in the black community. So this still is going to have a problem of joblessness in the black community. That's the only thing that will lift us up out of this thing.
Recovery?
On this point, though, then, if it's a good idea that mandatory minimums are going to be going away, and the recommendation from the Attorney General is that federal prosecutors should be very, you know, they should
that,
back
that
away from
that.
That
has to be one part, but the second part has to be dealing with the criminal records.
Right.
Most of the time, if an individual has a criminal record, especially a felon, you can forget about being hired at some of the major corporations in this country.
That's not going to happen.
And, well, those are the sort of wrong-headed policies that led to the mandatory minimums to begin with.
That's right. When we we're out of time. I was going to say when we come back. When we come back, we'll come back sometime to pick up on this particular subject because, again, the whole re-entry of someone who's getting out of prison, they've paid their debt to society, now they're getting out. Is there a safety net for them? Is there even a path for them to get a job in an economy? I mean, it's, you know, we may be creating another a good idea, but again, that's not been well thought out.
Unintended consequences.
Anyway, we are thankful for Salim Ulkill and Philip Beverly and Anthony Anderson and Doug O'Brien for joining us tonight on Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for being with us. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.